Thanks so much for joining us this evening. We're delighted to be hosting Carl Gershman from the National Endowment for Democracy. Short introduction, because you didn't come to hear me speak, but Carl has been the president of the National Endowment for Democracy since its founding in the early 80s. They do great work on strengthening democratic institutions across the globe. Publishers of Journal of Democracy, I'm sure Carl will have more to say a little bit. He'll say a little bit more about National Endowment for Democracy. He frequently writes and speaks on democracy issues, and he's passing through London. We've got an event tomorrow in North Korea, and we're delighted that he was able to dedicate some time to us on his way through. I'm sorry, I wanted to see a few new faces here as well. So welcome to the Legatum Institute. We're a think tank here based in London, and we do prosperity studies and studies on transitional democracies. And we're actually we'll be working with National Endowment for Democracy on a lecture series in Washington D.C. next year. And among other projects, we have some economic studies work that we do. A program called the Charles Street Symposium, a summer school, an annual summer school for young professionals, and of course our signature publication, the Prosperity Index, which is on the tables around, so feel free to take a copy. Without further ado, I'll hand it over to
Carl. Well, thanks so much, and I'm delighted to be here. I did come here because we're bringing together around 60 people tomorrow from all over Europe and Korea to talk about how to expand the work on human rights in North Korea. We've sort of started that, and it's been a very large area of my work, and in any event, that's why I'm here. But I'm an old friend of Jeff Gedman. I'm friends with Ann Applebaum. I regret that, you know, our paths have crossed, and she's in Washington this week. She's actually speaking at the NED on Thursday afternoon, and I'm going to miss her, which I regret very much. But there's a close relationship between the two institutions, and as was mentioned, we're going to be, you know, looking at the whole, with Legatum, we're going to be looking at the whole issue of the economic dimension of democratic transition and consolidation. You know, so much of this work has been focused on the political dimension, but it's so, you know, what happens economically and whether a country can become productive is so critical as to whether or not democracy can succeed. And so we're going to be looking at that. Let me just say a few quick words about the NED. I was talking with John earlier, and it's a complicated institution, and it's not necessarily well understood. We were created in 1984. The sister of Jonathan Lurie's mother was married to Lane Kirkland, the great American trade unionist, who was one of the founders of this institution back in the old days. The AFL-CIO was one of the only institutions in the United States that was engaged internationally. But around that time, with Reagan coming in, this was right after the transitions in Spain and Portugal, where the West German party foundations played an important role, the idea came that maybe the U.S. should do something like this. And Reagan gave a big speech here in Westminster, gave it 30 years ago, the Westminster Address to the British Parliament. In which he called for what became the NED. We just had actually a celebration of this out in Los Angeles, where we honored George Shultz and Madeleine Albright, raising money for the World Movement for Democracy, which is a global network that we've established of activists for democracy all around the world. And it met in Lima just last month, and we were raising money for that assembly in Lima. But it was founded as a grant-making institution with four institutes. That was the German idea, that our two parties would establish party institutes, party foundations, like the Germans Friedrich Ebert Stiftung or the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, that played this important role in Portugal and Spain in the 1970s. And so for the first time, our parties created institutes. And the labor movement also had an institute to operate internationally. And through that institute, that's where the main support for Solidarity was provided during the 1980s. And because everything had to be balanced, we created a business institute associated with our Chamber of Commerce to sort of look at that dimension of the problem. It's the only institute of its kind in the world because so much of this work is focused just on, as I say, on the political side, but the Center for International Private Enterprise works on the issue of the informal sector, corporate governance, and all sorts of issues, mobilizing the private sector to be a voice for economic and democratic reform, which is what a lot of countries have to do, which are beset by problems of corruption. So we had this four institute structure. It was kind of a very, very balanced. And then in addition to that, the idea was that we would make grants to others, people that work on media, civic education, NGOs that work on human rights. And that was really the idea. It wasn't supposed to be anything more than that. But over the years, it's evolved in a very interesting way where we still have these four institutes. They've grown enormously, and this field has developed enormously. There is now, David French is with us, there's a Westminster Foundation for Democracy now in the UK that was created about 8 or 10 years after we were founded, but it's now a big field. The European Union is involved. The European Union is in the process, as we speak, of creating a European Endowment for Democracy, supposedly modeled on us. It was an idea, the brainchild of Radek Sikorski, Anne's husband, and foreign minister of Poland. And when Poland had the presidency, this was what they pushed. It was right after the Arab Spring. They were also concerned about what happened in Belarus in the December 2010 elections. And they were concerned that Europe lacked the capacity to do this work. They were highly bureaucratic, and they could not provide direct support to people fighting on the ground for freedom and democracy. And the idea was take it out of the bureaucracy, and modeling it a little bit on the NED, that this is now being created. I think about 15 million euros have been pledged, both by the European Union and by governments. There's actually a vice president of the European Parliament who's formerly a British Tory, now a liberal, Edward Macmillan Scott, who was probably the lead person in the European Parliament pushing for this idea for a very, very long time, and had, you know, very close relationship for us, and kept saying, you know, we need something like what the U.S. has. And so that's a little bit about the background. The way it's changed since the beginning is that the independent grants program, the small grants that we make, has expanded enormously. We now make about 1,200 small grants a year to NGOs in, like, tomorrow, North Korea. We have about 15 groups that we support. A lot of them are defector organizations set up by a lot of the people who've defected and have set up organizations to try to reach back into North Korea with information and for more contact and also develop support systems. But I'm talking with John about Russia, which he's very concerned about. Probably 75 groups that we help in Russia. They're under a lot of pressure right now with the new NGO law. And we'll see how that goes, but they've closed down AID, and for that reason, the U.S. may be, you know, the NED may be called upon to play a larger role. They can't close us down because we don't have an office. We just have our office in Washington. And by the way, that's very conscious. We operate in a lot of tough places. There are a lot of governments that don't like what we do, and they, you know, we can continue to do what we do as long as the local groups on the ground, want to do the work. And in the case of Russia, which is actually rather interesting, they're not backing down. They're going to be challenging this new NGO law, which says that all NGOs which receive foreign grants have to register as foreign agents, really as spies. And there's even the prospect that some of them could be prosecuted under a new treason law. So it's very dangerous, but they're not backing down. It's sometimes the international donors that get frightened and walk away. But, you know, our job is to try to stay with these people and to be responsive to them and to try to help in every way. We think of ourselves as a kind of a comprehensive support system for people who do this work. We can provide grant support, financial support. Our institutes can provide a lot of technical support to people who work in their sectors, whether they're political parties, parliamentarians, trade unionists, business leaders, and so forth. We also have developed over the years both a research capacity and what I would call a activist capacity. The World Movement for Democracy is an initiative that we provide the secretariat for, but which networks the global democracy effort. We have a Center for International Media Assistance, which tries to focus on how media can be, the support for media around the world can be improved, and it brings the whole field in the United States together, but also then networks internationally. We just organized a donors forum, a media donors forum, which was attended by representatives of a lot of European governments, but both private foundations and governments that provide media support to bring them together to try to coordinate, to talk together about what they do. And this is another thing that we do. The Research Center is where we've connected with Legatum. I mean, we published the Journal of Democracy. Some of you may have seen that. It's, you know, I'd say it's the leading, it's probably the only real scholarly journal in the field of democracy, but it's both scholarly, but also publishes politically very relevant articles. In the current issue, the cluster is on Europe, actually. It's called European Disintegration with a question mark, looking at all the problems in Europe. Previous issue focused on Russia, Putin under siege. And it has articles on situations all over the world, and also think pieces about democracy. And we have a fellowship program. We have at any one time 9 or 10 fellows in residence at the NED for 5 months. The program is named after President Reagan, who was one of the two founders, and Congressman Dante Fassell, who was the Democrat, who, when after Reagan gave the speech at Westminster, managed the legislation in the Congress that became the NED Act. When I said before that they're trying to create a model of this in Europe, the European Endowment for Democracy, we'll see if it can really have the kind of independence that we were granted. And I, bless the Congress all the time for having granted us the independence that we have. We are a private organization. We receive an annual congressional appropriation to do this work. But the legislation that was passed in 1983, the NED Act, it doesn't fund the NED because it didn't create the NED, because the NED is a privately incorporated non-governmental institution, a 501c3 under U.S. tax law. But it basically protects us from government interference in our work. They have the right to audit what we do. We have to submit our annual report. But our board is entirely independent. And indeed, when board members retire, and we have a 9-year limit on board membership, it is the board that chooses the new members without having recommendations coming from the State Department. I think with the Westminster Foundation, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office,
they
basically, that would never happen with us. And what this gives us the capacity to do is to find the people we need. If you think about it, if you're making 1,400 grants a year, which is what we make, 1,200 small grants and then about 200 grants to these four institutes, how does a board stay on top of that? I mean, how does it not be a rubber stamp board? And what we've been able to do is find in addition to board members who can maybe help us raise money or provide political support in the Congress for what we do, we have people who are specialists in their respective fields, and they report to the board on the package of proposals in their region. So the world is divided into 8 regions from the point of view of making presentations to the board. And someone, I don't know if you know Moises Naim, who used to edit Foreign Policy magazine. He's a Venezuelan-American, used to be the Minister of Trade, but now is a prominent American intellectual and specializes in Latin America. He reports on Latin America. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, who was an Afghan-American, who was our ambassador in the UN, also ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq, he reports to the board on the Middle East. Andy Nathan, who's arguably the leading specialist on China in the United States at Columbia University, reports on East Asia. Francis Fukuyama, who people have heard of him, he's got a bigger name than some of the others intellectually, but he reports on, he's reported on the Middle East and Latin America before, but he can pick anywhere in the world, and now he does South Asia. But we have people who report on, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. Africa is a very large part of our work, and we're active, you know, in more than 20 countries in Africa, and in a very concentrated way in countries like Sudan, Nigeria, Congo. We're very concerned about what's happening in Mali and are thinking of expanding our work there right now, and also Ethiopia, which may have some opportunities in the aftermath of Meles Zenawi's death. Very concerned about Kenya, which is having an election coming up, and 500 people have already been killed in Kenya in political violence leading up to this election. Zimbabwe has an important election coming up, also a constitutional referendum. So these are countries that we focus on, and we tend to be able, with our grant support, to engage with the leading democracy activist groups in that country. And it's quite inspiring in a way to think that in all of these situations, from evolving and emerging vulnerable democracies, which is what we're going to be looking at with Legatum, to transitional countries like in the Middle East, to autocratic countries, there are people who are engaged in this fight. Maybe just a brief word on just key challenges. I've sort of noted them already, but let me just specify. You know, if you're active in, as broadly as we are, there are countries that fall into different categories. And one of the main challenges we face, and where the endowment is able to do its most effective work, because there are few others that operate in this field, is in what I would call autocratic or dictatorial countries. It's very diverse, because a country like North Korea is, while it's the communist system is breaking down in North Korea, it's the most closed country in the world. People flee to China from North Korea, you know, to have a better life and even more freedom. But we're active in China as a dictatorial country as well. Burma is a country now in motion, but obviously has been one of those authoritarian countries that we have been active in, and Russia, Belarus, Cuba, all of these countries we have, you know, very, very active efforts. And this is a big, big challenge. And I can speak in a way that sounds optimistic about these countries, because all of these countries have very serious problems, and you can see their vulnerabilities. But they're also, especially larger countries like Russia and China, operating internationally, pushing back against what we do, against what the West does through their media, Russia Today or Central China TV, CCTV. These are large operations. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they have their own operation to try to push their ideas and their system in the world. And there's really what I would describe out there today is a world of contestation, where the dictatorial countries have seen what has happened in not only in 1989, but also in 2003 and 2004 in Ukraine and Georgia, the so-called colored revolutions, and they're basically saying, we're going to draw the line. Russia has taken the lead in passing NGO laws to try to preempt this kind of work and to try to crack down on civil society to make it impossible for these types of events to take place there. And it's very sophisticated work. Somebody by the name of William Dobson has just written a book called The Dictator's Learning Curve, about how more sophisticated they are in the use of laws to control groups. In other words, it's not the rule of law, but the rule by law. The NGO law in Russia, the treason law, the law on slander, and so forth. So we find ourselves in all of these countries today in a situation of fairly sharp contestation. But when you engage on these, you see possibilities that you wouldn't see before. There is a real movement, for example, in Cuba today. Some of the leaders of that movement have actually been killed over the past year. Laura Payan, the leader of the Ladies in White, which was a heroic women's organization that marched for the release of prisoners, she died under very suspicious circumstances, let me put it that way. Osvaldo Paya as well, who was the Christian leader in Cuba, who died in a car accident in July of this year. And they've tried a the Spanish driver of the car. He was a Spanish Christian activist. But there's a call for an independent investigation because people say that there was a car that drove them off the road. It was something that took place in eastern Cuba. Point is that there is a real movement taking place. Over 1,000 Cubans have signed a demand for another Cuba. The leader of that was in prison just recently, but I just got word yesterday was released. But there's a very active and growing movement. In Venezuela, where they just had elections, the opposition was able to, you know, they lost. They were able to get, but they were able to get 45% of the vote in an election where Chavez spent over $20 billion, controlled the media completely, and where people feared that their vote would be known, and that if they voted against Chavez, they would lose their jobs, and they would be subjected to various forms of persecution. So that's an evolving situation as well, and the opposition remains united, and there are spaces in which they can operate. And even in a country like China, it's tightened up, but you know, if you speak with people who are from China, who are close to the situation, they're nervous about the future. They see the instabilities. There are over 200,000 collective actions of protests that take place every year now in China. The wealthiest people are seeking to leave or to take their money abroad. The number of people who are getting permanent resident status in the United States has quadrupled in the past 3 years to some 3,000. In any event, all of these countries have vulnerabilities. We can talk more about them if you wish. The second challenge that we face is the challenge of transition, very, very difficult transitions. Obviously, the transitions in North Africa are the ones that are on most people's mind, but there are also very difficult post-communist transitions taking place in Kyrgyzstan, in Georgia, in Ukraine, where you know things are not going well. And we're going to be looking at that with our research center to how we can understand these difficult transitions, but also we're providing support to many, many groups on the ground that are working in these situations. I might note, obviously Egypt is on a lot of people's minds these days, that it's something we're deeply worried about. We, the NED, our journal, have basically been the glasses, we've been in the category of the glasses half full on what's happened in the Middle East. And, you know, we'll see what's happening with Morsi right now, and whether, you know, whether or not the system is going to remain open. We don't know. And we don't know if it's his intention to keep an open system, but to try to steadily consolidate power into, I mean, our hope has been that that with all the problems of the democratic opening in the Middle East, with the Islamists coming to power, if you could keep the process open, they would have to adapt. They would have to become more responsive. I believe that's happening in Tunisia, which has a different history from Egypt and a more hopeful trajectory now. But I suppose I have to say that you know, it's unclear, especially the actions that Morsi has taken just in the past few days. He may have to back off of some of this, but it's a very perilous situation, and it's something we have to watch very carefully. In any event, these transitions become a second and very large and important area of what we do. And finally, there's the whole issue, and this is what we're looking at with Legatum, of what I would call vulnerable democracies. New democratic countries that are trying to do, you know, that are trying to move on the democratic path, but for many reasons, economic failure, crime, you know, the breakdown of the rule of law, you know, they have difficulty making it. And we obviously continue to support many groups in these in these countries. A country like Mali, which I mentioned before, in 2008, Mali was the chair of an international association created by Madeleine Albright called the Community of Democracy. Some of you may have heard of that. It's an international association. It was created in Poland in 2000 and meets every 2 years. And in the fourth round of these meetings, the meeting was held in Bamako, and Mali had the chair of the Community of Democracies. And yet this country that was seen as a kind of a beacon in Africa of democracy has just had a coup, and the North is being, you know, is subject to this terrorist violence, and it's a very, very dangerous situation. So countries that are, you know, these new democracies are extremely fragile. They have many, many problems of security and economic development and corruption that they have to deal with. And this becomes another, you know, important area that we work on. In these types of countries, it's not just the NED that does this work, because, you know, you have agencies like development agencies that can enter into these situations more than they would in the closed dictatorial situations. But our job is to support civil society groups, to promote independent media so there can be accountability. It could be means of, you know, coping with issues like corruption. Obviously, they need to develop stable party systems, so political party work becomes terribly important. Through our business and labor work, you try to make democracy inclusive. The theme of the assembly that was just held of the for the World Movement of Democracy in Lima was a democracy for all, ensuring social, political, and economic inclusion, because you have, you know, marginalized groups, poor groups, and so forth. So these, this is basically the scope of what we do and the basic challenges that we face. Maybe one final word. You know, our own countries today are in a lot of trouble, and Europe is in a lot of trouble. We're aware this is no longer a period of democratic confidence. A lot of the challenges that we face internationally are occurring at a time when people in our countries are concerned about our own problems. And so there is the potential for a real decline of commitment, a decline of support at this time. I don't think that what is required is an enormous investment, but I think it's very important to stay engaged at this time. I think, you know, we obviously have our own problems that we have to solve, but I don't think those things should be mutually exclusive. Let me stop there. I've sort of covered a lot of ground, and, you know, be welcome to take any questions about any of the issues that I've raised.
Okay, thank you, Carl. And I will take the liberty of asking the first question. You had mentioned a little bit about the work you do in North Korea, but I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on some of these other countries that are very difficult to access, like Syria or Iran, where there are a number of democracy challenges. Is there a place for NED
those types of countries, you're basically supporting groups in exile. Syria is in a civil war right now, so it's very hard to do the kind of work we would ordinarily do. But there are human rights organizations that have operated from exile. Some of them are playing a leading role in the Syrian opposition. A fellow like Radwan Ziadeh, who is the head of a human rights organization, was a Reagan Fussell Fellow at the NED, is a leading voice on Syria. Our NDI group has brought the Syrian opposition together in Turkey and Jordan to try to help them develop their agenda, their programs. So there's a lot that can be done. In Iran, it's mostly internet platforms from exile. Very difficult to do things inside, but you can stay connected with inside. One thing we can do in Iran is a website called Omid, which is Farsi for hope. And this is done by two young women who are the daughters of someone who had been an important Democrat in Iran in the 60s and 70s, then helped connect the nationalists to Khomeini when he returned, and then was murdered by the Iranian regime in Paris in 1991. And this was a website they created in honor of their father, and it documents, right now they document the executions, the deaths of 15,000 people, which is about a fifth of the number of people who've been executed in Iran. But it becomes a kind of the beginning of a truth and reconciliation process for Iran, and it's an interactive website where you can not only change the information about who is executed, but also
you know, they have documents on democracy, Havel's, you know, Power of the Powerless, which is translated into Farsi and so forth. It's an educational tool. It's also a way in which Iranians can begin to see that there were many different kinds of people who were killed and persecuted. All of these situations are different. I was telling David as we were speaking outside that one of the countries we're involved in today very actively is Bahrain, which in a way can be seen as the gateway to the Gulf. It's Saudi Arabia that essentially controls the situation. And a lot of the people that we support are now in prison, just locked up. Some of them are in exile. We continue to provide support. We do solidarity actions to support people as well. And when we were in Lima, we one of the so-called democracy courage tributes that we gave was to the Bahrain Human Rights Defenders Movement. And a young woman, 25 years old, was there, who is the daughter of Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, who is the human rights leader who went on a 110-day hunger strike, and just a really great hero. What Bahrain does is they say that all of these people are Iranian agents, because Saudi Arabia is in conflict with Iran, and they want to say that anybody who is opposed to the minority Sunni monarchy in Bahrain is an Iranian agent, and therefore a terrorist. There was a report that was done a year ago by the Egyptian jurist Bassouni, and it's now the anniversary of that report. On Friday, we're having a meeting in the Congress looking at the implementation of the 26 recommendations of this report. It's interesting that Bahrain wants to show that it's doing the right thing, but at the same time, it's, in effect, behaving like a... you know, harsh autocratic government. So you use those openings, those spaces, the leverage that you have through the impact of international opinion to try to influence these countries.